The COVID-19 pandemic has upended our daily norms, from grocery shopping to seeing family or friends. But public health crises throughout American history have also shaped another part of our lives, the law. From smallpox to the COVID-19 pandemic, laws have been shaped by epidemics, and the law has also had the power to impact how those outbreaks play out. Our next guest joins us to talk about how the law, government, and public health interact historically in the United States and how we can learn from the past for the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How should the legal system balance public health and safety measures against possible infringements on personal rights? Who should have the most power to react to outbreaks, national, state, or local governments? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Fabian Witt is the Allen H. Duffy Class of 1960 Professor of Law at Yale Law School. He's the author of multiple books. His latest is called American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
In the book, you make the case for why we should look back at the past of pandemics and our legal system in the United States. What kind of things can we learn by delving into the past like that?
Well, you know, for the last three quarters of a century, Americans have forgotten what a pandemic can do. And we've lost touch with the kinds of legal requirements and legal rules that we need to have in place to protect ourselves. And in some sense, we're back to the 19th century. And what better place to look than the 19th century to figure out some of the kinds of things that democratic communities have been able to accomplish in moments like this.
And this used to be more the norm. We had a lot more diseases to contend with, outbreaks, local or national. This was a very live issue throughout, as you say, the 19th century, from the birth of the country, right?
Oh, for sure. So from the 1780s and 90s with yellow fever and smallpox and measles and cholera in the middle of the 19th century, our ancestors, our forefathers, as we might say in constitutional language, you know, were used to these things. They were standard operating procedure, and they reorganized the world we live in to deal with them. The cities we live in, the towns, have rules about nuisances and where you can do what that are organized around and rooted in a long history of regulating for the common good.
A key point, though, that you raise early in your book is that the founders and beyond recognized the interests of government in regulating issues related to health, but they really put the power in the hands of state and local governments, not the federal government. Why was that, and why has that been an important factor?
Well, the power is the police power, you know, and it has nothing to do with troopers on the highway or cops on the beat. It's the basic power to look after the people in a community. And the U.S. Constitution, 1787, allocates that authority to the states and gives certain enumerated powers to the federal government. But that basic police power is a state power, not police power. And it's been that way in the U.S. All the way back, and it's really shaping right now. You can see it shaping our response here in 2020. If you want to see the history of the law matter, look at the way in which the United States has responded to COVID-19. It's states and localities.
We've seen legal challenges right from the start. How did we start to define what a state or local government can and can't do when it comes to regulating public health in the face of an outbreak?
So in the decades after the Constitution is ratified, courts uphold vast authorities for state governments. You know, you got to fight smallpox, you got to fight cholera, you got to be able to do that. It has to be able to regulate the way people live in order to keep people safe and let people be free. Both those things rest on holding epidemics at bay. What courts have done over our history is make sure that elected officials stay within legislative boundaries. They've tried to make sure that state officials respond to the electorate and respond respond responsibly. What they haven't done is step in and prevent elected officials from doing what needs to be done. That's been the historical tradition.
Talking to John Fabian Witt, author of the book American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. I'm looking, John, at a description you give. The Wisconsin Supreme Court blocking a state board of health effort in the midst of an outbreak, saying They have statutory authority to do things, but it exceeded its powers. The year is not 2020. The year is 1877. But the sentence would apply equally well to 2020. We keep doing the same things here.
Right. There are a lot of historical resonances. Americans have been challenging the legality of epidemic response, way back into the 19th century. There's an important difference emerging, though, right now, Rob, and it's one that I think we should all pay attention to and figure out what we think about. The tradition, 1877 Wisconsin, even spring 2020 Wisconsin, has been to insist that governors, mayors follow the rules set out by a legislature. But we've got a new set of cases being decided by courts around the country. And to be honest, the spring 2020 Wisconsin Supreme Court went a little bit in this direction, saying, actually, legislatures don't have the power to respond to pandemics. The freedom of the individual matters too much. And that's a worrisome development, because actually the freedom of the individual requires that we restrain one another to manage for our own health and safety.
And that's a key distinction. And you talk about this a lot in the midst of 19th century outbreaks or preparing for them. That idea that you just outlined, that we have to protect individuals and individual liberty. In some cases, the argument went by regulating their lives in ways to protect public health. That was the guiding principle, it seemed like, for a long time. Not that we ignored civil liberties, but they weren't the be-all and end-all.
That's right. I mean, Justice John Marshall Harlan, in a really important case called Jacobson against Massachusetts in 1905, says, real liberty is the liberty to go about your life confident that you won't get smallpox from someone who's near you. And that's the real liberty that he was interested in. And we see that run all the way through the 19th century, back right to the founding.
Another running argument you lay out is kind of two schools of thought in public health, and this ends up in the courts, a sanitation school versus a quarantine philosophy. Can you lay out that tension?
Right. Well, you can either control bodies, think quarantines, set down a cordon sanitaire, a limit on where people can go, a constraint on their freedom, or you can try to lift up the conditions in which people live. You can engage in tenement reform or clean the streets or something like that. And those two different strategies, one authoritarian, the other, call it liberal or progressive, but I don't mean to invoke any political categories from today. But one is attending to people's circumstances, and the other is attending to their bodies. And we've got both those traditions in American history running all the way through.
And another theme that runs through here is that the people subjected to the most stringent quarantines and treatments sometimes are the most vulnerable population. Immigrants, in some cases, poor people, black people, people with HIV during the AIDS crisis. The standards don't always get applied equally.
For sure. I mean, this awesome power, the police power to look out for communities, it's a little bit like the power to look out for communities in moments of war. These are emergencies of a certain kind, and that's an awesome and terrifying power, even if it's one we have to have. And of course, awesome power can be abused. And so we've got terrible examples of that in American history, from ignoring a smallpox epidemic among enslaved people during the Civil War, to targeted quarantines at the Chinese in the Pacific Northwest around the turn of the 20th century. Think of the Tuskegee experiments, terrible experiments on black men with asymptomatic syphilis all through the middle of the 20th century, and then up to the way in which HIV/AIDS gets ignored in the 1980s. So long history of the abuse of this terrible power, even though it's one we absolutely have to have.
And it ends up being counterproductive in some cases. John, you lay out cases where some of the groups you just talked about distrusted future public health efforts because those previous ones had been legitimately unfair to them.
For sure. I mean, that's one of the paradoxes of the law of public health. And you might think of the job of judges in these areas, in this public health area, as to try to do their best to make sure that legislatures are living up and governors are living up to their word, to try to channel official action, which is, of course, us trying to do the right thing to help our communities be healthy, to channel that official action into trustworthy, publicly accountable pathways. And that maybe that's the best way to build trust, which absolutely we need at these times. And of course, we don't really have right now.
We continue our conversation about the intersection of history, law, and public health crises with John Fabian Witt, professor of law at Yale Law School. His latest book is American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of legal challenges to public health emergency efforts here in 2020, here in Wisconsin, and how the courts have ruled on them? What do you think the role of the federal versus the state government should be when it comes to preventing and stopping pandemics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And John, let's talk about that last point. We've got the states taking the lead, and it's been kind of a piecemeal effort, clearly, with COVID-19. Is there a need, do you think, to revisit that division of labor?
Well, there's a need for more coordination. The pandemic affects different places in different ways at different times. That's been one of the lessons of the last 8, 9, 10 months. On the other hand, the pandemic doesn't get limited to one place. That's another one of the lessons. And so some kind of centralized coordination, even if it's just in the form of the use of the bully pulpit or some kind of inducements from the federal government to the states. So federal leadership would be useful. States will also continue to play a central role, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Does the law need to be clarified on this, or is this a practice thing that of what people are actually doing? Do we need to revisit our state and federal laws when it comes to pandemics?
Well, one of the important questions has been civil liberties as against the power of the government, right? And that you've brought that out from the beginning. And over the last couple decades, one of the interesting things is that public health authorities have been calling on states to respect civil liberties in moments of disease or for the pursuit of public health, in part to build trust with vulnerable communities. This is something we talked about before your break. And one of the interesting and scary things we're seeing right now is that new technologies might allow states to manage and police populations without their trust. That is, think of the smartphone or cell phone technologies that allow states to track people. So we're at a complicated juncture where some scary new developments could happen, and we got to keep an eye on those.
We are talking about pandemics and the American legal system. You can join in at 800-642-1234 in the conversation with John Fabian Witt, author of American Contagions. Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in Rice Lake. John, hi.
Hello there.
What do you want to bring up, John?
So I'm a physician, and I obviously practice in the state of Wisconsin, and with the recent rulings that have come out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, we have one of the dumbest Supreme Courts in the entire country, and lawyers know nothing about medicine, and I happen to have friends that are lawyers, but they know nothing about medicine, and I firmly believe lawyers and the courts should stay out of this whole argument, and it should be left up to the doctors to settle, because we understand what's going on.
John, thanks a lot for the call. And John Fabian Witt, this is a tension that's been there all along when courts and judges and lawyers are trying to sort out these public health and medical issues.
Well, for sure, for precisely John's reason, courts, judges have oftentimes not wanted to step in American history for fear of looking foolish. I mean, a smart judge knows that they're not experts in public health science, that they're not physicians, they're not scientists. And so they've wanted to do is manage the process to push legislatures to respond rationally to new scientific information and not step in and decide things on their own. But just as your caller suggests, we've seen some courts, Wisconsin, Michigan, a federal court in Pennsylvania, going a lot further and imposing their own view with potentially catastrophic results.
But on the opposite side of John's argument, doctors aren't lawyers. And these judges and lawyers are weighing not just the health and medical impacts, but the impacts on individual rights, hopefully on the rights, I guess, of communities, of vulnerable communities. They're looking at more than just the medical side of things.
For sure. And it's a delicate balance. You know, in that Jacobson against Massachusetts case upholding in 1905 mandatory vaccination in Cambridge, Massachusetts, what the Supreme Court says is a city can engage in mandatory vaccination. Let the science lead. But the Supreme Court says, we're not going to get out of the business entirely. We're going to make sure that if there's some especially capricious or cruel or unusual vaccination, then we'll take a second look. So courts haven't been willing to leave the field altogether.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on now Jesse in Madison. Jesse, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jesse?
So earlier conversation this week that was happening was with one of the Republican legislators who had said Evers has not worked with local municipalities to enforce the mandate. And I think it's interesting the duality between legislature and lawmakers making laws and the police enforcing them. If Evers is to put forth a mandate that isn't a law, and then he's then supposed to reach out to local municipalities to enforce that law, how are they to enforce it if it's not a law, and how is he to be held accountable?
Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. So, yeah, Governor Evers issuing mandates, citing a law, giving him emergency powers or giving the health department emergency powers. Those have been challenged in courts, of course. But then that we've seen in Wisconsin and other states around the country, John, local sheriffs saying, for example, they're not going to enforce this order. Can you talk about the state and local tension over orders like these?
Well, this too is a tough balance. You know, 102 years ago this fall in San Francisco, there were a bunch of protests over mandatory mask laws during the 1918 influenza. And the San Francisco police enforced the mask law for a long time. There were tickets given out and pretty substantial for 1918 fines handed out. And it produced a backlash. An anti-mask league emerged. And much of the politics of masks that we have today, we could see 102 years ago. And the lesson there is that local enforcement has to use good judgment. We're really not going to be able to get away from the importance of communities and individuals using good judgment. And right now in our low trust, highly partisan, polarized moment, it's hard to see good judgment. And that's one of our crises.
Jesse, thanks for that call. Dave joins us next in Wausau. Dave, hi.
Hey guys, thanks for taking my call. Thanks for taking my call. Thanks for doing what you guys do. I appreciate everything you guys do. Second of all, so it sounds like you're advocating, our professor here is advocating for more federal regulation in terms of mandates and that sort of thing. However, there is a massive difference between what happened in New York versus what happened in Wisconsin versus what happened in Montana. There is a specific law, and I know that one caller said that doctors know more than lawyers, but there is a law, there's a specific law that says that a health emergency cannot last more than 60 days in Wisconsin, and that is not a federal law, that's a Wisconsin law, and it doesn't matter what the doctors say. Doctors are not economists. Economists know as much as doctors in different facets. So, with that being said, when we in Wisconsin enacted our 60-day mandate, we did that way early. I mean, and if we were to take it into account the fact that there was only a 60-day mandate allowable in terms of legalese.
I got you, Dave, we don't have much time left. I'm going to jump in. First of all, John, I don't know that you were making the case that there needs to be more direct federal regulation within states, but you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, you just need to coordinate, right? That is, as long as Wisconsinites can go to Michigan, can go to Illinois, can eventually make their way to Connecticut, where I'm talking to you from tonight, then we need some kind of mechanism for coordination. And obviously, there's such a long tradition of really effective local control on these things. One wouldn't want to get away from that too much.
And as we wrap up, John, he was also mentioning we have this 60-day emergency law. But a pandemic doesn't necessarily work at our timetables. The law as it exists don't always match up with the next crisis, do they?
right? If only the virus would respect the 60-day mandate. You know, that's one of those things designed to ask our democratic institutions, our communities, to revisit basic questions of emergency policy. And so many of our political institutions right now are badly broken and are having a hard time revisiting it. And the project for regulating our country going forward, just like the pandemic going forward, is rebuilding that trust.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
John Fabian Witt is a professor of law at Yale Law School. His latest book is American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19.